This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Astute listeners will notice that this episode is a bit late. That gives me an opportunity to yet again ask the community if you're out there and you have some audio engineering skills and you'd be interested in giving back to the community. The most time-consuming part of the podcast is the editing process, and this last couple of weeks I've been very busy and it's been a challenge. So again, if you happen to be interested, please get in touch with me, gracefulatheist@gmail.com. If you are finding any benefit from the podcast, I ask that you please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. On to today's show. My guest today is Joel Furchess. Joel is working on a PhD in applied behavior analysis. His particular field of study has been conversion and deconversion. So today, Joel and I discuss an article that he has written called Why Do Christians Become Atheists? A Case Study. Joel is a Christian. He is, in fact, an apologist. He has taken great pains to do his study without allowing his worldview to interfere. I think it's important for us who have gone through the deconversion process to hear the perspectives of the believers, and in particular, the believers who are attempting to look at deconversion from an objective point of view. As you're going to hear, there are a few places where I push Joel quite a bit. I'm going to leave the editorializing for the final thoughts section, so please hang on for that. As it seems, I've had to say almost every episode, the internet connection between Joel and I was not fantastic. It introduced a fair amount of delay, and so some of our interactions feel a bit stilted. That is much more about the internet connection than either Joel or I. I also had to make some pretty hard edits, so you might hear some clips in there. I promise you that I didn't change any of the meaning of whatever Joel had to say. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Joel Furchess. Joel Furchess, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Well, thank you. I feel welcome.
All right. So, Joel, you have a background in psychology. You've got a PhD in behavioral analysis. You've been interested in doing research on deconversion and conversions. So tell me a little bit about your background, your education, and how you got interested in that.
I always love talking about my education because it has a life of its own. I've never done anything I've selected to do. So I'm an artist, right? But given that my parents were paying for my undergrad, they decided I should get a degree in something that would actually make money. And so they sent me in to do special education. So as I entered the field of special education, or rather I entered the academic career of special education, the head of the department dies. And so they stick somebody else in the department who has no idea what she's doing. She gives me a lot of bad advice. And as I approach my fourth year of college, I don't have the credits I need to graduate in special education. So the only credits I had, I could apply to a basic psychology degree. So I graduated with a degree I wasn't interested in and a subject I wasn't interested in. And then I got the only work that you could get with an undergrad in psychology, which was sort of social work. I was working with children with who had gone through abuse.
Okay.
Not to downplay that at all. It was a valuable experience, and I'm proud of the work that I did there. I eventually did get a master's degree in special education, after which time I spent time with the short version is juvenile delinquents.
Okay.
Sort of teaching teenagers from bad backgrounds. And then after that experience, I decided I would pursue a PhD in behavioral analysis. So currently I'm pursuing that in applied behavioral analysis. I'm about halfway there.
You're in progress. Okay. Tell me then how you got interested in deconversion and conversions specifically.
So I began freelance writing, I would say around 2012. And I was working for an online publication called The Examiner, and their model of news publication was to hire nothing but freelancers, which saves you money. And then they would assign each freelancer an extremely specific beat.
Okay.
So there were freelancers working for them that would follow a politician and write nothing but articles on that politician. The idea being that you, the reader, could find news on any subject that interests you that was very specific. And so the beat that they handed me was Christian apologetics. Now, it's difficult to find regular news that's interesting, at least at any rate, on that subject. And so at one point I decided to, in order to get my clicks, I would do a series on atheists that converted to Christianity, which is an interesting series of stories. It has that, personal interest route.
Sure.
And so I did that, and it became the most popular thing I've ever written. It was republished on a number of sites, including the Premier Christianity radio site.
Okay.
And so I got a lot of feedback on that. And from atheists, I got the feedback, are you going to be fair and do stories on Christians that became atheists?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, because of my psychology background, as I'm writing these stories, I'm seeing trends and it becomes very interesting to me. And so I did a case study on atheists that convert to Christianity, which is something we could talk about because I've since done academic study in that field. But at any rate, I was interested, in fact, in doing the opposite side, seeing whatever trends occur in that route. And so I began to, and at this point, I'm more advanced in my academic career. And so what I found was much firmer trends than I did for the atheists that became Christians, such that the stories were extremely predictable and there were themes that came up. So it was very fascinating to me. And I managed to buckle down, and now I'm almost constantly reading academic research in the field of conversion and deconversion. And I've been pursuing that for about 3 years now.
Yeah, interesting. So obviously this podcast is about deconversion, that process, my deconversion, but also many of the people that I interview have gone through deconversion as well. You have the five-stage model of deconversion that we're going to jump into in just a second and talk about specifically the version of Christians becoming atheists, so using the term deconversion. But let's begin with, you make the distinction between deconversion and just falling away. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your technical term that you use. But if you want to talk about that for a second.
Sure. Deconversion and then disaffiliation.
There we go.
Is the other term. So the process is, you look at the statistics. I think it was last year the Pew Reports published this statistic that was very highly circulated, at least in the fields in which you and I travel. Mm-hmm. And it was saying that there is a huge decline in religiosity in the West, specifically in America. So you have a number of churches shrinking in attendance and religion becomes less influential. So it would be tempting perhaps to think that people are just becoming atheists in droves, but that's not the case. Most people are just moving away from religion as a category. So the disaffiliation would refer to those individuals who used to be religious, but have become irreligious, but have not become atheists, which means they haven't taken a firm position on religion for or against. They're not interested in it anymore. And this, a broader class of Americans are falling into this. In research and when you do these statistics, you would refer to these as nuns, meaning they're not spiritual but not religious. They're not atheist and agnostic. They just don't have an opinion on religion. They're not interested. And that's disaffiliation. So the difference is that when you're an atheist, you make a statement on the nature of religion and your relationship with it, meaning that you come away from religion and you commit to something else. Now, I realize that the definition of atheism doesn't necessarily mean that I believe there is no God. But it does take a stand on what your beliefs and disbeliefs are, or lack of belief. If you press a disaffiliate, back them in a corner and twist their arm, they may make a statement like, well, there might be a higher power. I don't know. But football's on, so let me get to the TV.
So yes, I think you are relatively fair, or more than relatively fair. in your definitions of atheism. I know there's lots of arguments online about whether it is purely the lack of belief or a positive belief that God does not exist. But again, I think you hit the right tone with this. The thing I want to really, really agree with you on is this concept of disaffiliation. I feel like a lot of what I hear from the Christian community in relation to deconversion is really describing disaffiliation. It is the 18-year-old, the 24-year-old in college who just stops caring, stops, you know, just walks away. And although I can see why that's very, very important to the church, I don't think that it, not in all cases, rises to this idea of deconversion, of volitionally recognizing I no longer believe. And I think the more interesting category that is probably more difficult to study because of the lower numbers is adult deconversion. So people who have lived out their faith as a believer for some period of time beyond, let's say, college age years, and then some subsequent period of time decide that they can no longer believe.
Right. So the thing that I've noticed is that atheists still maintain a relationship with religion, but it's a relationship with religion that presses back against it. The American Atheist did a study very recently. It was a month or two ago. At least they released it a month or two ago, and they called it Reality Check. And the study was talking about, it was a survey that was based on things like an atheist feeling of being in a minority, sort of being discriminated against, and the ways in which religion seems to work to make atheists feel less acceptable in society, or those kinds of things. And then it sort of zoned in on atheists' political goals. And, you know, in the survey, they stated outright that the entire purpose of this survey was for purposes of political activism. It wasn't so scientific in its nature and rigorous in its nature that it could be published in a journal, but it gathered enough data so that they could present these data as a political activism source. And one of the things it said in the paper was that these nuns, these disaffiliates, don't vote. They don't become politically active to the degree that atheists do. And this is backed up by another survey. I wish I could cite it, but I don't have the citation in front of me, that showed that atheists as a category are some of the most politically active people in the United States in terms of voting and being activists. And so this again shows a difference between a disaffiliate and an atheist, because an atheist is taking an extreme stand. In the very act of labeling oneself an atheist, one is taking a stand on one's relationship with religion, which a disaffiliate wouldn't necessarily do.
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with that. I know that in some of your work, you point out the difference between atheist is a negative statement. It's about what one does not believe, as opposed to the positive statement. So just to have everything out on the table, I consider myself a humanist and a metaphysical naturalist and a secularist. All those things are positive things that I hold.
All right. You can draw values from each of those things.
Precisely.
You can't draw values from atheism. Atheism is, again, a statement of what you stand against.
Yes and no. So here's where I'll push back. The reason that I use the moniker graceful atheist is that is some of what you just mentioned, that there is a stigma still in the United States to come out as an atheist, particularly, obviously, in the South or very heavily religious areas, right? And so just being out about the fact that I do not believe and using the term atheist makes a statement, makes, in fact, a political statement mm-hmm. even. And it is purely in my case, the reason I use that is to help others who are going through doubt, going through this deconversion process, to know that they're not alone, right? There are those people out here who have gone through this process.
Sure.
So anyway, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. I think we agree mostly on those definitions. Mm-hmm. Let's move on then to your model. I'll give you the opportunity to maybe give us an overview, and then maybe let's go through one step at a time, and we'll chat back and forth on that.
Okay. So the first stage of the model is what I would call the preconditions. And the preconditions are the background one finds that are shared by at least every deconvert that I've ever studied or listened to. And this is the term that is typically used as fundamentalist. I avoid that term because there's not a lot of content in it. It's a broad term that can be applied to whatever you think falls under that term. Typically, when somebody says fundamentalism, they mean dogmatism. But, you know, somebody who is a theological fundamentalist would maybe disagree because there's a movement and so forth. And so it's a term that has a lot of baggage attached to it, and I don't like to use that.
Right.
Instead, I use the term modal typical. And by that, I mean there are certain modes of operation one finds in these backgrounds. And as these modes coalesce into a certain kind of church, that church becomes modal typical, if that makes sense. Well, I can go into those particular modes of operation as I've been able to pick them out from the data.
Yeah, let's go ahead and summarize this.
Sure. I don't have the list in front of me, so I may forget one or two, but I'll try to hit them all. The modes include isolationism. And this is probably the primary mode that I've seen across the board. And the idea of isolationism is it's sort of driven by this philosophy that there's a lot of dangers and pitfalls out in the world, quote unquote, that one wants to see the congregants and their children and so forth avoid. And so their way of avoiding that is to eliminate any contact with those things. And so in order to eliminate contact, you might homeschool or send them to a religious school. There's this idea of creating a Christian culture which sort of apes the quote-unquote world, but does so in a Christian context. So you create Christian movies for kids to watch, and
right.
you create the Christian version of pop music and the Christian version of teen magazines and so on and so forth. And then you prevent or disallow the individuals in the church from access to these sort of cultural context, things in the culture, and sort of redirect them towards the Christian version of those same things.
Right.
And so there's that. And then you discourage any kind of relationship with people who are outside the church. So you can't go get a beer with the guys because the guys aren't Christian and maybe beer is bad. I don't know. And so you get the idea. Isolationism, especially in the cases of children, is this idea of, you know, you shut them off from quote unquote, the world, the secular community, let's say, in order to avoid any kind of corruption that might be associated with those things.
So VeggieTales and...
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, I have written about this. I call this the bubble, in that it is a hermetically sealed environment where only reinforcing information is allowed in, mm-hmm. and all disconfirming information is shut down and not allowed in.
All right. And in terms of preconditions, this is probably one of the primary drivers of deconversion, but we'll talk about that as we move into the next stages.
Okay.
Another one, and this was brought to my attention by Dr. John Mariette, or at least his work, is this idea of spiritualism. So spiritualism would be related to emphasizing the more supernatural aspects of Christianity or religion. This is characterized by Pentecostalism, especially where one has these extreme ecstatic spiritual experiences. And you could, to a degree, associate it with things like Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism, because there's this constant feeling of being wrapped up in this larger spiritual world and this idea of, you know, as one takes communion and participates in the Mass and so forth, there's this spiritualism that surrounds one that kind of transcends the world, if you will. So yeah, you see that, but also you see it in things like, again, Christian fiction. There's this idea that there are demons and angels that are manipulating all the events in the world, and that if you are, I don't know, lusting after a woman who isn't your wife, it's because a demon has entered you and is causing you to do this. So it's this idea that the larger world is manipulated by these unseen forces. So that's another mode of operation that one sees in a modal typical church, this emphasis on spiritualism.
And it sounds like you're specifically referring to the Frank Peretti novels and this whole concept. I think people, particularly, I'm old, so growing up in the 80s, seeing a demon under every doily.
But sure, yeah. It's an exciting notion for a Stephen King-esque novel.
Yes.
So another one is performance control. And again, this is very instrumental in what one sees in the deconversion and post-deconversion crisis, especially. And this is the idea that it's actually related to isolationism or the Christian bubble, because there's this community that forms, and it causes this recursive loop of performance control, meaning that there are certain activities or behaviors that are disallowed by the community, and there are certain activities and behaviors which are celebrated by the community. Mm-hmm. And so the community becomes its own controller of that, because every individual within the community is controlled by the approval or disapproval of the larger community. And of course, approval is one of those things which humans strive for, and disapproval is a punishing factor. And so you really start becoming aware or attuned to one's own behavior, because you're in the process of judging the behaviors of people around you, meaning that you're instrumental in the performance control of those people, and they're instrumental in the performance control of yourself. And so as you're restricted to this sort of hermetically sealed environment, the entire environment determines the behaviors, you know, micromanages your behaviors, if you will.
Right. And I think you use the term legalism, you know, having a very legalistic environment where there are a lot of rules, and breaking those rules have consequences.
I avoid that word only because there's theological implications and sort of churchy concepts that come along with that. And performance control has a broader application.
Okay. Textualism.
Okay, yeah, this is a big one. So this is the idea that it's sort of the wooden version of inerrancy or incorruptibility of scripture. And so this is this idea that scripture is the only pure source of information of truth in the world, such that any kind of information or assertion that you run across has to be compared against scripture in order to determine its truth or falsity. And so there's this kind of idea behind textualism that the Bible, or, you know, we could bring other communities into this, the holy book of this religion,
sure,
was written directly by God, handed to human beings, and it was written for the benefit of every human being everywhere throughout time. And so if a young girl in Bulgaria in the 17th century picks up the Bible and reads it in her language, and your kid picks it up tomorrow and reads it in his language, they would get the exact same meaning out of it, because it was written for them and for every other human being by God. And so this is what causes the sort of difficulty, struggle in the mind of people who then see inconsistencies or disagreements between people about what the Bible means. And so this is a pretty tough row to hoe, because it really restricts you in terms of how you read the scripture and how you respond to it in light of other information you come across.
Yes, and there are theological landmines there as well. So if you start mm-hmm. to lower your sense of its inerrancy or authority or what have you.
Yeah.
And then your last one was about compulsive certainty.
Okay, yeah. This is really instrumental in the deconversion. The compulsive certainty is this idea that one must have high confidence in order to be within the community. So the act of questioning or doubting is in and of itself evidence against the religion. Because if one is in, if you're spiritually within the religion, if you're saved or inhabited by the Holy Spirit or something like along those lines, then you are going to be completely confident, and you're going to have some level of certainty. So you're certain that the scripture is true. You're certain of the pastor's message. Mm-hmm. And when you're certain of your salvation, and when you become uncertain, this is much more difficult than it would be otherwise without this idea of compulsive certainty. I read a paper about this that really, because this was something that I had a lot of difficulty with as I was studying deconversion stories, because I constantly ran across these ideas of the discomfort of the absolute certainty. And I've had actual atheists hit me with this when interacting with them, like, oh, you guys believe that you have the pure truth or something like that. And it I didn't understand the objection at the time, and I didn't understand all of this idea of now as an atheist, I have to say I don't know about things. But then I read a paper that made it clear to me. It put fundamentalism, what I call modal typicalism, at one end of a spectrum and nihilism at the other, such that if you don't maintain the certainty that comes along with fundamentalism, you're stepping off the edge into uncertainty, which is essentially nihilism. You don't know anything. You don't know you're up from your down if you're doubting any specific of the belief that you hold.
Okay. I will say this. So one of the things that I'm going to bring up a little bit later is, as I was going through this, I definitely recognized many of these elements for me. Mm-hmm. And yet also my belief system was one that I saw these in my communities and I thought they were wrong. And I was actually arguing against them within my community. And so they do apply to me. I'm not terminally unique, but at the same time, I think I recognized that these things were generally not good and that the particular communities I was a member of, that was negative, right? It was hurting that community. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to bring up with you, and John Marriott has the same concept of these setting conditions. You know, what is the ideal then? You know, what would you say is, if you were talking to churches, what is your advice to them? How is it that, in some ways, it seems like blaming the victim, right? Oh, well, you just happened to grow up in the wrong community. So how do you address this?
Okay. Well, I know that I myself think that it's important to be able to say, I don't know. I myself will not argue a position, will not take a firm stand on a position that I haven't studied to the degree that I have the ability to support it. Unless I have some confidence in a particular idea, such that I know both sides of the argument and I can elucidate them and support one side or the other, I don't take a firm stand on that. It's intellectual humility. And intellectual humility is the idea that you could yourself be wrong and you have to be open to listening to both sides. This is honestly one of the things that you see in people who convert between religions or deconvert, is that from a psychological profile, they are open to possibilities. They tend to be more open to exploring possibilities beyond what it is that they specifically have been raised in. Now, as a behaviorist, these are all setups to a particular behavior when you come up against certain other conditions. So, you know, once a behavior becomes unuseful or aversive, that behavior is ditched in favor of a behavior which is more supportive to the environment that you're moving in. So all those behaviors work fine if you're isolated within your Christian bubble, as you put it, but they become not fine if you move into an environment where they no longer work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would advise intellectual humility and the ability to say, I don't know about things.
I love it. I agree with you. I think there should be more room for doubt and the expression of doubt. And I think the church would keep more people if that were the case. I want to give a dumb analogy because I think you're right about the personality type of being open. And I think that's in reference to the oceans personality typing concept of being open to new things. I find that in my life, as soon as I run into something that is where I find, oh, well, this is a better way of doing this, I change my behavior. And a dumb example of that is I'm a runner. 5 or 6 years ago, I read an article about you should tie your shoes like this other way than almost everyone ties their shoes. And I thought, yeah, that is a better way. And I changed my behavior. And so I do think that that is a personality aspect. And again, we'll eventually get to, I did have a conversion experience into Christianity as well as a deconversion experience out of Christianity. And it was this, the intellectual humility or the moral humility of wanting to be correct, wanting to learn, wanting to know what was true. So that was your step one. And now let's move on to your step two, the stressors.
Okay. So stressors are a broad category And, you know, there are other researchers, I think John Marriott was one of them, who, you know, would specify very particular stressors. But it's this idea that the system in which you are doesn't work for you under particular circumstances. And, you know, one of the common stressors would be doubts.
Sure.
You know, you come up against, say, a contradict in scripture that's no longer meshes with the textualism that the environment has ingrained in you. And so you have this sort of cognitive dissonance of how do I handle the fact that this textualism isn't working under these circumstances? And, you know, you could go through all the categories of the modal typical church, all the modes that I just mentioned, and, you know, you can come up with a way in which those modes would be disallowed by environmental circumstances. So those are stressors. Stressors could also be life circumstances. You know, there are relationship problem, you know, marital problems. And, you know, this becomes a stressor. And then if you say we're to pray to God that that goes away and it doesn't, then this, again, runs against the sort of doctrine that you've been taught. And so, you know, the system of belief is no longer working for you under that circumstance. So again, these stressors boil down to generally those two things. They're environmental circumstances that are literal stressors. They cause you stress, mental difficulty, those kinds of things. Now, one that I've run up against, and after I published the article, I had a commenter come on and comment on things like sexual abuse within the church. Now, this is not something that I had commonly run up against in the specific cases that I studied, although I heard things about that on listening to shows like yours, where deconverts were interviewed. And then, again, in reviewing John Marriott's work, he actually was able to discover cases where this is the case. So, you know, spiritual or sexual abuse, I've heard about spiritual abuse a great deal because on shows like yours, I'm sure you've had people come on and talk about
Religious trauma syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. RTS, religious trauma syndrome. I haven't studied that at all. I'm not equipped to speak on that, but I've heard about it a great deal when I've listened to deconversion stories. And so, yeah, obviously this would be a stress or whatever it happens to be. Now I have some theories on that, but again, I'm not equipped to speak about them. So I'll leave those out of the case. So again, okay. So you have doubts. That's a stressor. Yeah. Doubts accumulate. You have life circumstances. You go through financial trouble. You go through marital struggles. You lose somebody who's important to you. You see an instance in which somebody is suffering and God should not allow that, but he does. And so this, you know, is not consonant with your particular religious views. And so what this is a circumstance under which there's an accumulation of circumstances or ideas which are not consonant with your beliefs. And they begin to accumulate you when you become primed for deconversion. And so as you become primed for deconversion, you hit the next step, which is the trigger. Now, the trigger is some kind of circumstance. It might, again, it could be anything that falls under the stressor category, a doubt or a life circumstance, which gives one intellectual permission to then begin exploring the doubts that they have accumulated. And so there's this idea that if your system's important to you and there's this taboo against questioning that system, or, you know, especially what would happen if you abandoned it, you know, if I abandon religion, I might go to hell or something like that. And so there's a strong reason not to question this system because of the fear of what would come next. But as the stressors begin to accumulate against that barrier that's keeping you from exploring these, there is some point at which that cracks. There is a specific instant circumstance or question that becomes the trigger, which again gives you intellectual permission to then explore the doubts that have accumulated during the stressor phase.
So I've got several things here. One, this is where I think you and I align fairly well. I've written an article called How to Deconvert in 10 Easy Steps, jokingly. I talk about the precipitating events as the same thing as your stressors, right? These are, And what we're hearing a lot from the very high profile deconversions are analogies for these. They'll say, I started to pick at the thread of the sweater.
Sure.
Or they'll say,
empty the pool, the bricks. Yes, I've heard lots of these.
Yeah, lots of analogies for this. I recently interviewed Amy Logan, who is a Mormon. And she said, well, this is my shelf. Like every time I had these experiences, I just thought, I can't deal with that right now. I'm going to put it on the shelf and we'll think about that later. That really resonated with me. Sure. Tim Sledge calls it the exceptions to the rule of faith, that as he was going along mm-hmm. in his ministry and things would happen and he would say, well, that's an exception to the rule of faith. And absolutely, they mount, they begin to build up. And the thing I agree with you very much so is the idea of this triggering event. And you specify that in many deconversion stories, sometimes the triggering event is blamed either by the deconvert themselves or by the Christian church. And yet it's really just one more brick on the back or one more straw that it's the thing that becomes obvious. But all of these things have been mounting up to that point.
Sure. The person has become primed at that point. You know, they've become groomed or ready or however you want to put it, such that they are conditioned in such a way that deconversion is now possible. Now, something I don't write in the article that I put, but and I didn't include this specifically in the model, is that there are environments that a person can enter or that become conducive to the deconversion. It is more comfortable to deconvert under certain environments than others. This is why you often hear these stories of, yeah, my kid went off to college and then became an atheist. Well, college just happens to be an environment outside of the church where it's more comfortable to question those religious beliefs. It's very uncomfortable in that religious bubble, if you will. But once you go to college and you're no longer in that religious bubble, there's more of a permission to explore these. And, you know, the environment becomes conducive to that. And I think that one of the reasons you're seeing such a drop in religion in the West is that the Western culture has become more comfortable and conducive to leaving the church. You know, as secularism advances, it creates this sort of soup that we're all immersed in that gives you options. There's a marketplace of ideas and you have more shopping options, if you will. You know, deconversion has become more comfortable in Western society now.
I definitely agree. And I will say that it's the explicit purpose of the podcast here to kind of convey that idea. I guess my challenge to you, the pushback I would give you is, shouldn't one's faith be able to withstand scrutiny or the marketplace of ideas?
Well, shouldn't one's faith be able to stand, you know, this makes certain assumptions about faith as a mechanism and, you know, where it lies. I would say that having a larger marketplace of ideas is actually a better thing. It's pushing against these ideas. It's the idea that I must not shop in that marketplace. You know, I must avoid that marketplace at all costs. And then when life circumstances force you within that marketplace, you have to do what, and this is an actual psychological term, tinkering. You know, I come across an idea. Let's say I come across somebody who swears they saw a UFO. Well, now in my mind, I have to somehow accommodate that to my current worldview. You know, this person says they saw a UFO. Does my worldview tolerate the ideas of UFOs? Well, now I have to make adjustments within my worldview to kind of compensate for this new thing, this new idea or piece of information that I've come across. And this is what, you know, social media and internet allow you to do to some extent. You encounter individuals that have different perspectives than you, and they seem like nice, reasonable individuals. You can have a conversation with them. You share many commonalities. You like this person. And so you're less, you know, insofar as you're not demonizing this person any longer, it's more difficult to dismiss those things that they say. And so now you have to tinker with your ideas. You have to take the things that they present you. You have to modify your ideas to include whatever it is that they're presenting you with. And as tinkering continues, one's sort of mental structure becomes less robust until it falls to a point where they can't adhere to a dogmatic system.
Yes, I agree. And if we can just push that conversation, I think we can call that deconstruction. I think you also use the term leftward drift.
Well, that's a mechanism within that, but that's not the system itself.
Okay, I want to challenge you just on one thing here, and because this, okay. I really want to get to the point that I'm trying to make here. The conservative idea of marketplaces is that things through competition get their correct valuation because of that competition. Okay. So my question is, when Christianity or theism in general is exposed to the marketplace of ideas and it is rejected, is the market wrong?
Okay.
Or I guess I'm asking you, how do you interpret that then?
Well, I don't interpret it. This is not something that I have the capacity to speak to truth or falsity of it. I can tell you how it operates. I can tell you what the topology and the methodology behind it is. But in terms of truth, I have enough intellectual humility myself to come to you and say that I don't have a handle on what's true or false. I am for the marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. I actually think that's important. I enjoy hearing both sides of an issue and coming away with a more robust idea of what both sides of the issue are. I think that what endangers a person is coming to the debate to hear both sides of the view, absolutely certain that the one holds against the other and not prepared to hear both ideas and give them their hearing. This fluidity, this intellectual humility, is actually more conducive to learning and growing as an individual than dogmatism. And so this is, you know, I'm in the process also of looking into studies of atheists that have become Christians, and this is not my own personal project. I'm looking at the academic work on the subject. And, you know, you see a lot of similarities right there, because the atheist begins with this concept of Christians that is sort of cartoonish in nature. It's the sort of straw man of what Christians are like. And then they encounter Christians that are intelligent, encounter Christians that are not hypocritical and not beating over the head with a Bible or whatever their caricature of Christians was. And then this is not consonant with the worldview that they had prior to entering into this conversation with a Christian. And so now they are given intellectual permission to start considering the Christian ideas. And, you know, to an degree, there's also a preconditions sort of a primer in those instances as well. So in a way, it's a very similar process. But this dogmatism on either side makes it more difficult to hear, listen to, and compensate for the various ideas brought to the marketplace. So I am for the marketplace. I'm for intellectual humility myself.
Okay, so two things. One, I just want to push a little bit on, I think what's interesting about deconverts is that they don't have a caricature of Christians because they were Christians.
Sure.
Right. Or believers in whatever faith tradition. So they are slightly different, but I agree that the cradle to grave atheist out there has some caricatures of Christians and what have you. So that's interesting.
Well, if I could respond to that point for a moment.
Sure.
Having grown up in a modal typical environment, being ensconced into this Christian bubble actually does form a caricature of Christians, because most atheists that I encounter that were deconverts are deconverts from a very specific kind of religion. And that's in their head. That's what religion is whatever the soup that they were immersed in, that hermetically sealed bubble that they knew as Christianity. And in behavior analysis, there's this concept of experimental control. And experimental control is this idea: you have to find out whether or not a thing is the independent variable that controls the behavior in the first place. So for, you know, a very simple example would be, let's say your kid is having trouble sleeping at night. So you put a nightlight in the room and their sleeping gets better. At that point, you know, most people are satisfied. Okay, the nightlight was the solution. But in behavior analysis, what you would do next is remove the nightlight and see if their sleeping patterns returned to what they were prior to putting the nightlight in. And at that point, you've proven with scientific certainty that, you know, the nightlight was the independent variable under which the behavior was controlled. Okay, so what the point I'm getting at here is, it's actually interesting to study the few cases in which a person deconverted and then reconverted. And why is that? It's because if their behavior returns to religious behavior after having been an atheist, you can kind of start to parse out the environmental conditions which caused the deconversion in the first place and are not present in the environment whence they return to the religious behavior. And so this is why I would say, yes, there is a caricature in their mind. I can say that specifically there's a case maybe I can refer you to the YouTube video later of a person who deconverted and then reconverted. And he describes the fact that as he reconverted to Christianity, it was because he saw that the version of Christianity that he deconverted from, he was still deconverted from. He still didn't believe that version of Christianity. He just found one that worked with his worldview. So now I think that deconverts still have a character of Christianity in them, mostly. Obviously, I'm not willing to make that as a categorical statement, but for the most part, yes.
I understand. I guess what I'm trying to share with you, give you some mm-hmm. insight, is as a deconvert, mm-hmm. what I often hear is whomever I'm speaking to, mm-hmm. whatever faith tradition they're in, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, the nuanced way that they express Christianity, they assume mm-hmm. that whatever background I have wasn't that, and therefore that is okay. That's the reason.
Sure.
And so if I'm talking to a Catholic, it's because I was not Catholic. If I'm talking to mm-hmm. a Pentecostal, it's because I wasn't Pentecostal. Yeah. If I'm talking to a Baptist, I was Pentecostal or what have you, right? It doesn't matter
sure.
what it is. It's that my version of Christianity is correct.
This is the right version.
You weren't the right version. So I'm pushing back on just that a little bit, just to say that
okay.
you are going to find people that deconvert from all kinds of flavors of Christianity, from fundamentalism to very liberal versions. Mm-hmm. And that I think you should take that seriously is all I'm saying. So I'll drop that at this point. I have another question for you, but I'm going to save that for a little bit later. Let's move on to your fourth step here, the process, because I think this is really important as well.
Mm-hmm. So the pop term for process is the deconstruction. I like to use deconstruction in a technical sense. Mostly when I hear atheists talk of deconstruction, they use it in a very broad blanket sense. But I think the word is helpful if you give it some technical value. So when people go through the process, they've obviously gone through the trigger at this point. At this point, they are, as I've said, exploring, intellectually exploring all of the stressors that have brought them to this point. And so at this point, there tends to be two different ways in which they approach it. One I call a rescue attempt, and that is this person really wants to be religious, but circumstances have prevented them from being religious. And so they're making every effort to rescue their religious beliefs before they fall into the abyss, if you will. And I say that from the perspective of the individual who's trying to rescue.
Sure.
This is not me being pejorative towards atheism. But then there's the other, which is, you know, I would use the term deconstruction in the technical sense. And deconstruction is much more aggressive against the religious ideas. And, you know, at this point, the person may be comfortable being aggressive against religious ideas because the church environment in which they've come from has become aversive to them. You know, it's uncomfortable. There are disagreements or mental or physical problems that they've had with this church environment. And now they're giving themselves permission to deconvert by finding flaws in the environment, reasons that the environment was wrong, or their teaching or their beliefs were wrong, such that they can comfortably leave that system. And so, you know, I mean, one is an attempt to return to the system. One is an attempt to leave the system. That makes sense?
Yes. And again, this is a point of agreement between you and I. I definitely see a technical difference between deconstruction and deconversion, which is your fourth and fifth steps.
Yep.
That deconstruction is probably a very long process. It is the small changes one makes to wrangle the cognitive dissonance, to be able to still believe mm-hmm. and live in the very complicated world that we live in. Mm-hmm. I also think that in the community, my community, we often use the term too loosely, and I think it has a technical meaning.
Yeah, value. It's a valuable term if you use it correctly.
In regards to rescue versus true deconstruction.
I'd like to talk about rescue if I could.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So I find that rescue falls under one of two categories. One I call content rescue and one I call belief rescue. Under the content rescue, it's the individual who really believes that if any particular belief they've had were to fall apart, the whole thing falls apart. It's sort of a house of cards. And so they want to seek reasons to defend each particular belief that they have. They're trying to defend the content of their beliefs. The rescue of belief is an attempt to remain religious, but there's willingness to compromise on the technicalities. on the particulars. And so you had mentioned leftward drift earlier. Leftward drift is the term I coin for people who are attempting to rescue the belief. And, you know, they're making compromises. And in order to do so, they tend to shuffle to the left. And I'm using left in you know, political and theological terms here.
Sure.
So, you know, if they're coming up with a theological problem, say a problem against inerrancy of the scripture, at that point, they can escape that as a problem if they shuffle to the left theologically a little bit, you know, drop inerrancy a bit, soften up in that respect and allow that, you know, these are very, very old documents that were cobbled together by nomadic people. And, you know, there might be some kind of inspiration in them, but that inspiration has been lost to a degree over time as they've been transmitted. Again, that's one characterization of a more liberal view of inerrancy. I wouldn't be able to represent them properly without a little more study, but you get the idea.
Yes.
So, you know, this would be a theological leftward drift. The other would be more of a political or a culture leftward drift where, you know, maybe it's okay to go see an R-rated movie. Yeah.
Or have that beer.
Exactly. But then, of course, you know, one sees it most commonly. The limelight, of course, is on the issues of things like women's rights and LGBTQ issues and things like that. And so, you know, once one gets into the political realm, within modal typical churches, they're very much tied to political views. And so this individual comes from a circumstance under which they believe that in order to be Christian, they must adhere to very specific political views. And as they see those political views being challenged, typically by moving into an environment where they're standing face to face with a gay person, for instance, and they find out that this is a very likable person and that this is important to their identity, et cetera, you know, this challenges their current notions. And so in order to remain religious, they have to shuffle to the left a little bit in order to allow for this emotional problem that they're currently having.
Yes. It's much harder to hate someone that you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, this happens. And as they drift to the left, their religious notions fall off. And, you know, at some point they arrive at the same place you're at, where they can derive values from a sort of secular or humanist perspective, and they don't need to appeal to the religion for those values any longer. And at that point, religion becomes sort of unnecessary. And that's okay. It's unnecessary, but, you know, more specifically, it's aversive. It's difficult to handle. They begin to dislike a lot of the things about religion that they've come to believe were integral to the religion. And so at some point, there's this desire to fight back against the environment they've come from. And so they not just abandon the environment, but get the hell out of Dodge.
So, yes. So let me push back again.
Okay.
So what's important here is that I've never thought I'm angry at God. I've never thought the church has hurt me. I've never thought until later that, you know, the church was wrong in these ways, et cetera. But after deconversion, I've got to tell you, I've been to a lot of church services after deconversion with family members who are believers. And there is a level of manipulation in the rhetoric that I was completely deaf to prior to deconversion that is screaming in my ears now. So yes, I respond to that. I'm upset by that now in a way that I wasn't before. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, and I've said this before as well, the deconversion is very much like conversion in that there's this sense of the scales fall off your eyes, right? You see the world different.
Okay. So in conversion studies, which I do equal to deconversion studies, I read a lot of the material and interact with conversion as much as I do deconversion. There is one similarity that is essentially what you're describing, and that is the creation of narrative. So if you were to go through a conversion process, then you look back along your life up to that point, and you tend to see this idea that the hand of providence was stepping in. God was manipulating events to bring you up to this point. And that now that you're within the church, all of these problems that you had before have been relieved. And that this was the purpose of those problems. And the first you've created that narrative, you have a testimony, a quote unquote testimony. And forming that testimony and the ability to give that testimony is important to your identity as a religious person. And you see something similar with deconversion.
Sure. Yes, you did.
Because after you deconvert, you look back along your religious life and you see it in a much different light. The example I like to use is the movie The Usual Suspects. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have, yes.
Okay. So if you remember near the end of the movie, this whole time, the entire movie has been a narrative from this individual that the cop arrested. And he's been telling the circumstances that brought him up to this point. And so he tells the story and that's the movie. And then at the end, when he walks out, the cop, you know, looks around and realizes that he was telling a BS story the whole time.
Right.
And, you know, he starts to see the little pieces where the story came from. And then he like starts to review the story in his head and realize it was completely different story than what he thought it was.
Yes.
And you, as the viewer, go through that process with him. And so you walk away from the movie and it's, you know, it's become a really cool movie now because the whole, you know, you've got something to think about. You can look back across the movie and see how it was presented one way, but it was really another. And it becomes a movie with two layers to it.
Exactly.
And the same thing is true about this narrative that you form as a deconvert. You look back across your life as a religious person and you begin to realize, I believe this. This was untrue. Why did I believe it? Oh, I believed it because of this. And so you begin to, you know, look back and see the manipulations and see the, you know, the things that led you to a conclusion that was wrong and all of the different institutions and structures within the middle typical environment that formed your identity as a Christian and how that was damaging to you as a person that left religion. And so you look back across this, you form a deconversion narrative. You now have a different story to tell than you would have as a Christian. And so it's interesting because in that moment that you're having a spiritual experience, you're having a particular experience that you could describe in that moment as a very positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could come away from that sermon while a Christian and look back at that sermon and really feel inspired by the sermon because of your worldview at that time. But then you look back at that spiritual experience as an atheist or at that sermon as an atheist, and you begin to see it as sort of a manipulative thing. You know, I believe this because these circumstances were around me and they were causing me to believe this when it was untrue. You know, and the pastor said this, that, and the other, and that was a manipulative way to get me to believe a thing which was untrue. I think it was Rhett and Link when they were giving their deconversion testimonies recently. Link, I believe, was the one who was into the music. Mm-hmm. And he would talk about how, you know, he'd get together with the praise band prior to the service and talk about, well, we'll start up right here at the point at which the pastor says this to really give this sort of inspiring tune, you know, and so it's a way of manipulating the environment to, you know, give a sense of inspiration where there is none. And so you look back at that when you were under the influence, when you're experiencing it, you believed one way. Now it's an event that is aversive to you because of your current set of beliefs. Yeah, that narrative is important because this is what you do on your show here. When you interview people who have deconverted, they're giving their deconversion narrative, which sounds a lot different than the narrative would have been prior to that deconversion.
I agree. So just a few things. One, yes, if you happen to listen to some of the back catalog, the worship leaders are fascinating people to listen to because they talk about the formulaic nature of creating a worship environment. Leave that aside.
Yeah, I've heard it once or twice.
I feel like you've got the details right, but are missing the heart somehow of what I'm trying to say.
All right.
First, let me admit what I admitted when I talked to John Marriott.
Mm-hmm.
I am fully aware that as a human being, we create post facto rationalizations for the decisions that we have made, right? So given that caveat that I'm human, so that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying about my deconversion is that I don't blame anyone for manipulating me. First of all, I didn't grow up as a Christian. I actually did have a conversion experience. I've seen you talk about the lack of conversion experience.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look back, the thing I think the most, the thing that resonates with me the most is I was mistaken. I interpreted what I thought was a revelation from God or the presence of God as being external to me from a, you know, what was beautiful at the time, conception of God.
Yep.
And what I'm telling you now is when I look back, I'm not angry at my earlier self. I just was mistaken.
Yep.
I don't know. So definitely when I hear or go to a church service now, I have a different perspective, but mostly it's with that knowledge of I was mistaken. And so this is different now, the way that I'm interpreting it. So I agree with you that for sure I have a deconversion narrative. I appreciate that that is true. I have taken pains to remember what did it feel like when I was utterly convinced, and what were some of the steps along the way in which that being convinced stopped being the case, right? And I guess there's a dismissiveness sometimes when I hear Christians talk about deconversions that misses the heart of it, right? and we're going to get to this in just a second. But, you know, if I know what it's going to cost me and I am forced to deconvert or be public about it anyway, it is because something powerful and significant has taken place to some degree beyond my control. Anyway, I'll stop preaching here. You can respond to that, or we can move on to your last step, the deconversion.
Well, I mean, obviously, having never undergone the experience directly, I can't speak to the first person emotional value of it.
Right.
You know, I can only speak to it from the perspective of an individual behavioral analyst and see how the behavior changes and under what circumstances and the preconditions, you know, and does that speak to the truth of the situation? No, I don't think it does. It just speaks to the topology of the situation.
I agree. And there's a part of any psychological studies where, and you talked about it earlier, trying to narrow down the dependent variable, in that human beings don't have individual dependent variables. We have a suite of rationalizations. We have a suite of motivations and purposes. And it's very, very difficult to do that in a scientific setting. Although I'm glad that you're doing it. I think that's the right thing to do. I think we should also be humble in what we derive from such a study, knowing that human beings are slightly more complicated than, let's say, physics in a vacuum, right? It's a little harder to pin down exactly what changes a person.
I don't know. What's John Marriott's background in terms of psychology?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Behavioral analysis looks at behavior for the behavior's sake. And so it kind of removes, like you said, the cognitive or human element to it and views it as a very cause and effect kind of circumstance. And there's value in that in terms of understanding the road and the things under which behaviors are controlled, but it's not the kind of thing you would sit down in a therapist's office and have them talk to you about.
Sure.
That's a way in which behavior analysis is not very popular in the broader world, but it is very successful.
Yeah. Again, I want to say there's value in doing the study. I'm glad that you're doing it. I'm glad to hear people like John Marriott and yourself, that the church is interested at all, I think is a good thing. That's a positive thing. And trying to do it from a scientific point of view is great.
Well, John Marriott does it and then writes books about how to avoid it. I'm not interested in doing that. I'm not interested in the theological question. I'm not at this stage interested in preventing it or allowing it. I'm interested in the data. I'm interested in the landscape of a deconversion and what it looks like. What people do with whatever data I come up with is their own business, but I don't have an agenda at this point.
Fair enough. I'll accept that. I don't want to finish without getting to the last stage here. You again make the distinction between deconstruction and deconversion. And so in your mode, what is deconversion?
Okay, so deconversion would be the stage at which the person is willing to label themselves. I am no longer a Christian. I am something else. You know, and I would accept that abandoning the label of Christian could in some sense be a deconversion, but you're not taking a stand on religion at that point. You're saying, this is what I'm not, but you're not defining yourself as something else. And so you haven't made that transition from this to that just yet, because there is some conviction involved in atheism, whether or not it is the belief that God does not exist or the belief that I have no beliefs.
Agreed.
But yeah, there's still a conviction in adopting that label. So deconversion would be the point at which you're willing to adopt the label. And, you know, part of the deconversion is what I call the deconversion crisis. To be distinguished from crisis deconversion.
Right.
Crisis deconversion being a technical term which refers to a point at which you rapidly move from believing you're a Christian to believing you're an atheist, usually because of some crisis event that occurs. But a deconversion crisis is the process of moving from Christian identity to the atheist identity. And this is what, you know, you've described earlier as coming out as an atheist, because the people that I find most likely to adopt the label of atheist and deconvert are the people who tied their identity most importantly to the church.
Yes.
So, you know, if you were a person who, you know, attended church, but didn't get heavily involved in the church community, you know, didn't really start studying the theology and adopting it, you know, that kind of thing, it's easy enough to drift out of the door and not cause much of a ruckus. But when you have tied yourself, when you, you know, you are obviously a Christian in that community, such that the community looks at you as a Christian and part of them, you know, one of them, you know, one of the things I was fascinated to find is that so far, I think all of the deconverts that I've studied were involved in some capacity in the church. Many of them went to seminary. Yeah. They became pastors. They taught. They were involved. They really wanted to be involved because this was important to them. And so, you know, deconverting is a serious thing, and it's part of this crisis of reforming your identity. If I am not a Christian, what am I now? Idea. And then there's the bigger social problem with that, because the community in which you were most active, the people that were your friends and family and so forth, was the church community. And, you know, the thing that one ought not to do as a Christian is to deconvert, because that's moving from one of us to one of them. And then the church has at this point become an aversive environment to you. You go there and there's a great deal that is uncomfortable to you at this point, because you decided compulsively that this is wrong. And you just, you know, you describe that to me. There's a level of manipulation, you see, and so forth. So you can't remain in the community because it's very uncomfortable. But you can't leave the community because it's very uncomfortable. Yes. You have to, you know, you have to make that decision. You have to be true to yourself. And so you come out, you leave the community, and then the community has to adopt, you know, has to change your identity in their mind. You know, and especially the fact that you were so active in the community, you were teaching, you were, you know, involved. And now everything that you said and did has to be dismissed or avoided because you no longer believe it. And so therefore it must be untrue, at least in the eyes of the people who were in the church.
So let me just say, yes, I definitely agree that I think the most dedicated Christians become the most vocal deconverts. Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. Quick editor's note, here I completely misunderstood Joel and went off on a rant of my own. I am cutting out my rant. I'm going to leave Joel's clarification that follows this.
Okay, so when I said that, I was referring to the people in the church who listened to your sermons,
okay,
who read your material. Now they have to deal with the doubts about what you've said to them,
yes,
and what you professed, because if you said that, you know, Jesus was the Son of God, and now you've deconverted, you know, what does that mean to me as a Christian now? You know,
right.
I can no longer trust what it was that you said to me. And so there's that level of having to change. You know, it's a difficult process for everyone is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't referring to the person who became an atheist. I was referring to the difficulty that the Christians have based on that person's deconversion.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. Apologies. Sorry. I definitely did mishear you there. So, what would you say to the apologist class who, when every new high profile deconversion takes place, they have a hot take. Do you have any advice for them on what they should say, what they shouldn't say? Do you agree with them typically? What's your take on that?
So the apologist community tends to focus on the trigger event, and they, you know, tend to easily come to the conclusion that it was this one thing that caused the person to become an atheist. And if that one thing can be answered, then the whole, you know, experience could be swept under the rug for whatever reasons. And so, you know, I would say to them that it's much more complex than that. And that's an oversimplification of the situation. The other thing I would say to Christians in general is that it's not their responsibility to reconvert this person. They have not failed because this person deconverted, and they will probably not succeed in reconverting this person. So it's to respect the person who has deconverted, respect their experience, and to, you know, give them the same right that any other human being would have, which is to defend their views and interact or engage in those views as important. So, you know, it's interesting to me because I can't remember what it may have been John Marriott who, when he did his study, he looked specifically for atheists that had a strong conversion experience. Now, I've studied conversion. I know the models of conversion and the steps involved in conversion. And, you know, that was an interesting thing in my study is that I did not encounter individuals who went from being a not Christian in their mind to being a Christian in their mind. Typically, they had been surrounded by a Christian environment. They may have answered an altar call. You know, they may have said the sinner's prayer at some point, but they did not translate from a certain belief, a specific belief, say humanism or Mormonism or something like that, to a different belief, which is the idea of conversion, is it's a transition from this to that versus deconversion, which is no longer that. And so if you had a conversion experience where you made the transition from this to that, that's unique to me in terms of what I've studied. So I would be interested in hearing your conversion story.
Sure. Yeah, no, that'd be great. So the setting conditions of my life is that, you know, it was, my family was very nominally Christian, and I mean really nominally, you know, and so I joke that I, as I became a teenager, I would be like, who is this God character anyways? I distinctly remember a moment driving the car with my grandmother where she told me the Apostles' Creed for the first time. I'd never heard it. And she felt great shame that I had never heard it before, right? So it was that kind of thing. You know, they were believers, but in the most nominal sense you can think of. And in fact, the another setting condition there is that my great-grandmother, her mother, was a very, very strict Methodist, very, very legalistic, very intense. So that was kind of my view of Christianity. What you need to know is that my family also has a tremendous amount of substance abuse, so alcohol, drugs, in particular with my mom. So when I was 16, 17 years old, my mom was at a bottom of alcoholism and drug addiction and had a literal epiphany. She had a crisis conversion. She was very gentle with me and just basically bought me a Bible and said, you might be interested in this, which I proceeded to read. And so without really any church background of any kind, you know, I've been to, you know, a handful of churches, but never with any seriousness. I began to read the Bible and pretty much all of it, all of the New Testament for sure. And most of the Old Testament. And I was swept up by the Jesus of the Gospels, you know, that I came for the sick and not the well, the religious leaders were whitewashed tombs. And I was like, and as is clear all the way into my humanism, that grace was this huge thing for me. I got a hold of Paul's writings of, you know, it is by grace you have been saved and not that of yourself. What I recognized at that point in time, I talked about moral humility, was a sense of that I was not perfect, that I made mistakes, that I, you know, that I wasn't good to everyone, that kind of thing. And this, the grace and the love in the character of Jesus was profound and life transforming. So over a process of about a year, probably in the middle of that, you know, I decided that I was a Christian.
Okay.
And what is interesting is it probably takes a year or more before I step foot in a church for real. And when I get there, I'm 18, 19, something like that. And I went through the process of going, why do they think this? Why do they do this? That's not in the Bible. Where'd they get that idea? So from the get-go, and again, I am aware I am not terminally unique. It sounds like I'm saying that, but from the very early stages, I thought, well, they have lost the sense of grace, this transformative grace that I've learned about. And so, of course, what is common to the stories that you've described, they've put me to preaching almost immediately. and you know, went to Bible college, had very similar experience of, you know, loving my Bible college teachers. I say that Jesus won my heart, theology won my mind, it gave me something to work with, gave me the underpinnings for all of those beliefs, that kind of thing. So although mine wasn't as dramatic as my mom's, it was very much a conversion. It was very much a, you know, subsequently, I definitely answered altar calls and things like that. But it was, for me, it was that reading of the Bible over approximately a year.
Yeah, so that would be a process conversion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So this was when you were a older teenager too.
Yeah. You know, I say, you know, I definitely wasn't an adult by any stretch of the imagination, but I definitely had, I've always had an independent streak. And I, you know, I have my own ideas. And one of the things that is fascinating to me is as I became a part of the Christian community and still held on to grace as the driving factor, I really felt like that was the message that God wanted me to tell people. It never occurred to me that these people who have lived it all their lives should know it better than I do. One of the factors in the deconversion was coming to the understanding, like a visceral understanding. And again, this is, to put in your terms, a stressor, not the trigger, was realizing that there were people equal but opposite of me. There was the legalistic side, and that you could make the Bible say whatever you wanted. And so my confidence in my interpretation of the Bible as being a document of grace began to crumble a bit, in that I recognized that you know, most of the people around me, that wasn't the way they interpreted the Bible. And who gets to decide which one of those interpretations is correct?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, thank you for that, because again, that does sound like a more firm conversion story than I've mostly heard from these. And so it's interesting to hear that. And I'd love to hear more stories like that, because the general process that I've come to is that mostly what's responsible for the deconversion is the preconditions, is this sort of environment that the person has come up in, such that they don't have the flexibility that one would need in order to encounter new ideas and adjust their views without abandoning them necessarily.
Right.
Yeah, and I see this in atheism too, because, you know, there is a level of confidence that I see in atheists, at least the most vocal ones, that is not dissimilar to the level of confidence within these modal typical environments. And I think that, you know, to a degree, this is one of the tools that makes a certain flavor of atheism so successful, is because the confidence itself is persuasive. You know, if you can assert a view with confidence, the fact that you have confidence in that view is runs sort of contrary to this, you know, the other idea that only the people with the truth can be confident in that truth, can be assured in that truth. And so the fact that this person is coming across in a confident manner, it becomes uncomfortable to the other person by virtue of the fact that they have conviction, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. A statement, a question, and then we're wrapping up.
Okay.
The statement is, the people that I follow, like the philosophers that are actual real philosophers that try to talk about these kinds of things, both on the theistic and the secular side of things, there seems to be this consensus happening that the values that underpin beliefs are the things that really one has very little control over, right? You grew up in a particular environment and you have a set of values, and those values influence the way that you believe. And one of the things that is important for me and was both in my conversion and my deconversion was the search for truth, the search for meaning, the search for the important things, the big questions. So what led me into Christianity is exactly the same. And again, this is post-fact to get that, but like the exactly same motivation that led me out. The difference is epistemology. And I know that you know this word because I've heard you use it. And that is that what I didn't have was the education in how one understands knowledge, how one gains knowledge or has confidence in some knowledge. What changed was that I started to care more and more about evidence, and here, for simplicity, empirical evidence. And that's what began to weigh so heavily against these beliefs that I held dear. I wanted them to be true. I desperately wanted them to be true. But the very fact of how desperately I wanted them to be true was part of the thing that was in the back of my mind saying, you better look into this more, right? And so as I began to go, when I gave myself permission to go look, right? I was not an atheist yet, but I gave myself permission to go look. It was that recognition of, I care about evidence in a way that I don't hear from apologetics. Apologetics makes many arguments, strong arguments sometimes, but I realized I cared about empirical evidence and that I wasn't going to find that. And so anyway, those are my post-fact reasons for deconversion. The last question I have for you is this. Have you seen any asynchronous experiences between conversion and deconversion, meaning that one happens in one direction and not the other?
Okay, I hear what you're saying. No, I would say that it's the opposite. I actually see a lot of similarities between the conversion and deconversion experience. Because again, I read a lot of the literature on models of conversion and the psychology of conversion and so forth. And every time I read one, it's interesting to me how I can form parallels between the conversion experience and the deconversion experience. Now, I've used this word a lot, the aversive thing. Now, one of the things that drives a conversion experience is that the person is a seeker. They're a person who desires some other context in order, or framework in order to situate themselves because of something in their life right now that needs handling. And so, you know, at some point that fixes whatever kind of disconsonance that they're currently experiencing. And so, you know, they become familiar with the religion, they become comfortable with them, and that's what drives the conversion experience. There's more to it than that, but sure, that's one of the preconditions, is that, you know, they have some discomfort in their life. Now, you know, I mean, to be fair, sometimes evangelism is kind of like salesmanship. You create the discomfort that then you sell the solution to.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's that. But the point is that there is some discomfort that drives that. Well, the same is true of deconversion. Like I've mentioned that the church has become an aversive environment. There is some discomfort in their life that religion is no longer solving and in fact might be causing. And so, you know, and I've mentioned this, one of the stressors might be some kind of life circumstance, like losing your job or losing your marriage or something like that. So you come under the stress. And, you know, you go to the first place that you're supposed to have a solution to stress, which is the church, which is your religion, which is prayer, which is the Bible, what have you. And it does not solve the problem. So this is a situation which is no longer working for you, and you have to start searching outside of the religious context in order to address the difficulty that you're currently having. And so this move outside of the religious context in order to address your problem becomes sort of a life motivator as well. So again, I mean, it's the same thing. There's a problem, you're looking for a solution. In order to find the solution, you seek an environmental change.
I'm just going to give you an opportunity to tell people how they can reach out to you. How can they find your work?
Well, a lot of my focus currently is on my conversion and deconversion research. And so this is not something I'm slowing down on currently, even though I published the article on. My agent has suggested that a book might be doable on this issue. So,
Okay.
But at any rate, it would be a way to follow my research would be on Twitter at Side Switching or on my Facebook page, not my personal Facebook profile, but the Facebook page, which is Switching Sides. I actually post more on Facebook than I do the Twitter only because it allows me more words.
Yes. Yeah.
Sometimes I blog about stuff that I'm researching, but honestly, I do more posting on Facebook than blogging on the subject. And of course, Hub Page is where I publish the article. I also publish articles, which is different than blogging, but only after I've done sufficient research to do so.
Great. Well, I'll definitely have links in the show notes for those things. Joel, I really appreciate you coming on the show to share your research with us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. It's been a fun time.
Okay. Well, I think that was a really fascinating conversation. I really appreciate Joel coming on to share his research and his perspective. I think you could hear it from me that I was pushing Joel on quite a few fronts. If you're a believer and you come to this conversation and you are thinking, wow, David's kind of a jerk. He was really pushing Joel when Joel was just stating the facts, as it were. I need to explain that just a little bit. I do my homework before I interview people. And I read a number of Joel's articles, not just his research article. I listened to a number of his podcast episodes. He is the co-host of the Mentionables, which is an apologetics podcast, including a couple of those episodes in which he talks about this research. And in many ways, I think I was responding to those conversations, which may or may not have been fair of me. So Joel, if that was upsetting to you, I apologize. But Joel and I have agreed that he will get this audio and be able to respond to it however he likes. This is my feelings on the matter. So I want to respond to a couple of things about this conversation that Joel and I had here. The first thing I want to say is that it sounds like I'm almost being anti-science when I challenge the behavior analysis a bit. Joel rightly says that behavior analysis is not maybe the most popular thing in the world. What I want to do is clarify. I'm very much for taking an objective, dispassionate look at things like conversion and deconversion, and I think that's good. The data analysis is useful, it's insightful, it's very, very helpful. What I am challenging is the strength of the conclusions that one can draw from a small sample set. So rather than talking about Joel's research here, let's talk about the Perez-Valieres research entitled, How Do Religious People Become Atheists? Joel refers to this research in a couple of his articles and in a few podcasts that he has been in. I have it linked in my How to Deconvert in 10 Steps. So here is a published scientific paper on deconversion. And the point I want to make here is that they have an N, a sample set of 36. Six people they live interviewed from the Clergy Project, which I think is a great idea. I think that gives a really good perspective. And 30 other people. And the point I want to make here is that the conclusions you can draw from 36 people is not that strong. The point I was attempting to argue in the podcast in this conversation was that human beings are very complex and that we tend not to reduce to simple inputs, outputs, reasons, intentions. It's very difficult to isolate causes and effects for human beings. And a simple example of that is all the attempts to say that coffee is good or bad for you, or a glass of wine is good or bad for you. It's hard to reduce human beings to one dependent variable. That was my point. Again, I'll just restate that I am glad that Joel is doing this work. I'm glad that there is an attempt to objectively look at conversions and deconversions and draw out as much as we can. But this leads me to my second point. My second point is this. Joel's model is great, but I honestly couldn't help but every time he'd make a strong blanket statement about all the people he looked at, all the deconverts that he studied, and yet I didn't quite fit that paradigm. And again, the criticism here is not that Joel did something wrong, but rather that if you find your model is incomplete, if you have a model that all swans are white and you come across a black swan, you have to adapt the model. The model has to change. So there were a number of things that didn't quite fit for me. The number one of which that we discussed was that I do in fact have a conversion experience as well. This shows me more that there needs to be more study. There needs to be more investigation of people who have gone through deconversion. And that again, drawing conclusions from that is not simple. It will take time, research, dedication to get that done. Another idea I want to explore here a little bit more is the idea of the marketplace of ideas. I want to make clear, as Joel stated, that the market valuing some idea over another does not tell us the truth or falsity of that. For example, atheism has had a low value for quite some time. We're still only something like 4% of the population. So it's not about truth or false. However, the dominant paradigm of religious thinking in the United States has been Christianity for so long, and it is now losing that position of power. And some Christians, maybe not Joel, are having problems with losing that valuation. And I just find it interesting that many of those people are also conservatives, and they also value markets. Markets are starting to devalue Christianity, and yet they believe in markets. It's an interesting idea that I'd like to explore further. Another point that I think I agree with Joel on is that vocal deconverts tend to have been very dedicated Christians. And again, I think this is something that the Christian perspective should take seriously. If the most dedicated Christians become the most vocal deconverts, what does that say? Is there something important about that? And the last few thoughts, I want to point out that part of my resistance towards Joel is that the model seems a little too neat. It seems to attempt to explain very complex things in very simplified ways. Just a simple example, I always took responsibility both for my conversion and deconversion, and I never felt like I was being manipulated, even though I now see the manipulation, if that makes any sense. So some of those setting conditions just didn't apply to my experience. And so suggesting that all deconverts have those particular or some set of those particular setting conditions is somewhat incomplete and maybe a little too simplified. When I first deconverted, I read a number of books, and several of them talked about the sophisticated theologian. And at the time, I didn't quite understand what that was getting at. And part of it is that when you are talking to a very bright person like Joel, who has a lot of education, and you are trying to pin them down to a statement of truth or falsity, the sophisticated theologian can melt away from that in very sophisticated and intelligent and educated ways. And so part of my frustration, I think, coming through in this conversation was trying to get Joel to an honesty contest, to something personal on his part, something real and heartfelt, and I feel like I failed to get us there in this conversation. Again, that might be unfair to Joel. Joel can respond to this and let us know what his reasons or purposes for this conversation were. Okay, I've already said too much that is a bit unfair because Joel isn't here to interact with me. I want to state again how much I appreciated Joel coming on, the research that Joel is doing, the work that he is doing, the way he presents it, the attempt to be as objective as possible. All of those things are very, very good. And throughout the conversation with Joel, you'll notice that I was trying very hard to agree with him as strongly as possible when I could. And I think he has a number of very good points. And so I would like all of you to go and read his article, Why Christians Become Atheists, and let us know. Give me some feedback. You can send us in a voicemail through the Anchor app, or just recording a voicemail on any recording device and sending it to me via email at gracefulatheist@gmail.com or send me an email and tell me what you thought of this conversation. Also, I'd like to know, is this something that you want to hear? Do you want me to have people on the podcast that I actually disagree with? Or do you really want us to continue to focus on the decoverts themselves? Let me know. Write in. In the meantime, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for some footnotes. The song is a track called Waves by Micaiah Beats. Please check out her music. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to help support the podcast, here are the ways you can go about that. First, help promote it. The podcast's audience grows by word of mouth. If you found it useful or just entertaining, please pass it on to your friends and family. Post about it on social media so that others can find it. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This will help raise the visibility of our show. Join me on the podcast. Tell your story. Have you gone through a faith transition? You want to tell that to the world? Let me know and let's have you on. Do you know someone who needs to tell their story? Let them know. Do you have criticisms about atheism or humanism, but you're willing to have an honesty contest with me? Come on the show. If you have a book or a blog that you want to promote, I'd like to hear from you. Also, you can contribute technical support. If you are good at graphic design, sound engineering, or marketing, please let me know and I'll let you know how you can participate. And finally, financial support. There will be a link on the show notes to allow contributions which would help defray the cost of producing the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, or you can send email to gracefulatheist@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at gracefulatheist, or you can just check out my website at gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. Get in touch and let me know if you appreciate the podcast. Well, this has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Grab somebody you love and tell them how much they mean to you. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.